introduce our speaker today. David Bosworth is a professor in the University of Washington's Creative Writing Program, where he previously served as its director for 5 years. He's the author of the book, The Demise of Virtue in Virtual America, The Moral Origins of the Great Recession, which just came out very recently. I'll pass this around. You have flyers around that describe the book as well. He also wrote the award-winning novel, From My Father, Singing, and the short fiction collection, The Death of Descartes. His fiction, poetry, and literary and cultural essays have been published in many journals, including The Public Interest and The Georgia Review. He's also contributed to a number of collective projects on cultural change in America, working with the Institute for American Values and other organizations to address issues like the fragility of the American family and the corporatization of public education. He's currently working on a book about epistemological change, scheduled for publication in 2015, so he's doing double duty here with both books coming out quick succession. His BA is from Brown University, and we're really delighted to have you here, David, so please join me in welcoming.
Thank you. So I'm ready to start?
That's
okay.
Thanks
for the invitation to share some of my ideas on what I take to be significant and in many ways worrisome transformation in the American character over the last 60 years or so. The title of the book, as Eric just told you, is The Demise of Virtue in Virtual America, The Moral Origins of the Great Recession. Though the project really began before the Great Recession itself, though it did emerge out of an anticipation or an urgency that some kind of national calamity was going to occur, and that was going to occur out of our own misguided beliefs and practices. In sum, the book is a cautionary study of what happens when strictly economic models, methods, and motives are given the license to regulate not only the office and the factory, but also the civic square, the public airways, and through them even the domestic household. And it supplies something of the history of how that license was given. I'm planning to proceed as follows here, if this is okay with everyone. I'll read a brief introduction, then I'm going to try to anticipate some of the most obvious questions you might ask and give answers to them as succinctly as I can, and I hope to define in the process a few of the key terms that are central to my narrative and analysis. And then I want to make some claims about the dangers of our current ethical environment. Following from that argument, what I call the moral field that we all now share. And then after that, we'll turn it over to the conversations. And if I could seize the mic again, being a professor, professors like to seize the mic, I guess. Because this book was very good for me. It's hard to write. It clarified a lot of things to me about the changes going on in American life. But it also left me with a series of, I think, really crucial questions that I don't have answers to. And I'd like to sort of, you know, send them out to you and allow you to walk away with them as well as myself. Okay, here's my introduction here. Earlier this year, after the publication of Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, a milder version of the fury spurred by our economic system's gross injustices finally migrated from the tents of populist activists into the blogs of the chattering classes. I say that as if I'm not among the chattering classes, but I guess that's probably not true. We're chattering here. The surge in financial inequality that Piketty enumerated is a truly worrisome phenomenon worthy of debate and needing redress, but the emphasis on a strictly monetary measure of contemporary capitalism's social dangers masks the full range and depth of its destructive impact on our civic character. To a degree that communism never could, consumer capitalism does produce the goods, even if it distributes them unevenly and often unfairly. Yet contrary to the Pollyanna theory that has justified over 35 years of economic policy, it in no way naturally produces the good. As most religions have preached and fairy tales have warned, unchecked self-interest, whether in the form of self-liberation for the individual or deregulation for the commercial corporation, is not a plausible route to enlightened behavior. Rather than fidelity to family and community, it leads to dissension, dissolution, and addictive consumption. Instead of animating a meritocratic marketplace, it produces lobby loopholes, golden parachutes, and stifling monopolies. Disdaining plain speaking for the fog of expertise, it crafts the fine print of liar loans. You may know what those are, but there was the housing bubble, and toxic assets. Fathers fleeing their children for a second bachelorhood, and companies deserting their countries for tax-free havens are the unacknowledged ethical twins of our time, as intellectual cult leaders Wilhelm Reich and Ayn Rand have a lot in common. I'm rare among analysts in stressing this, but the financial meltdown of 2008 was, at its core, a moral catastrophe, and one generated by decades of systemic deceit and self-deception, lie after lie, whose history I trace in the demise of virtue in virtual America. Okay, so now I'm going to sort of pose some questions to myself and answer them, I hope, in some way that can clarify and organize and present the book in a simplified form. So what do I mean, then, by virtual America? Although our nation's geographical coordinates are essentially the same as they were in 1946, we are now living in a dramatically different place, all humanly built or composed, our days increasingly spent inside an allied set of physical and digital architectures. The American story has become an inside story in that sense. As exemplified by our host of office cubicles, enclosed malls and amusement parks, surround sound videos and online simulated realities, this virtual America is highly indoctrinating, but because the temper of its ideology is so often seductive rather than coercive, because it usually is presented as either harmless entertainment or unambiguously good economic progress, we do not easily recognize its pernicious effects nor personally acknowledge the power of its persuasiveness. Insomuch as this new place superficially touts traditional American values, even as it relentlessly undermines the conditions necessary for their survival, virtual also refers to the inherent duplicity of its self-presentation, to a masquerade of normalcy which conceals an agenda of radical change. One of my discoveries or claims in this book is that if you want to plumb the true origins of ethical change in this country, you look to the cultural center, not to the margins where all the blame gaming in our culture wars was taking place. So the book focuses on, this is a chapter on malls, on Disney storytelling, on Reagan's presidency, dealing with supposedly the middle of the country and how normal and powerful organizations and people have been authoring or behind some of the changes we are experiencing. So what has designed this new American place and to what ends? Well, as you probably gathered from some of my preliminary statements, this ongoing enclosure of the American experience is being directed by the most central and conventional of institutions. Corporate commerce is empowered by decades of privatization. Although decorated by the arts and delivered by science, virtual America has been designed primarily to generate profits. And chapter by chapter, the book then details how the economic values narrowly associated with production and consumption, ruthless efficiency in the workplace, and seductive salesmanship in the marketplace now dominate the spaces we inhabit. I mentioned a little later, those are not coherent values, ruthless efficiency and consumption, seductive consumption, but they nevertheless are what prevail. Some key dates here I might just toss out, often unnoted. In the 1920s, the first broadcast telecommunication system was radio. It happened very quickly, and it turned out to be that consumer advertising would finance that telecommunication system. It was not a given. That is a political decision. So that while you really need to pay attention to any form, new form of telecommunications and how it reverberates throughout culture and changes it, that particular change, you still could have that telecommunication system and not have it be financed and administered in the way that it is. And I think that's a crucial change in the sort of ideology of everyday life that took place then. Another date that's important in my mind, sort of symbolizing what happened in the post-war period, is 1955, most commonly romanticized as the center of peace and prosperity in American life. That was the year that Disneyland opened in a totally enclosed space, a new version of what amusement park was. In Edina, Minnesota, the first enclosed mall was being designed. In Milltown, the first mass-marketed psychoactive drug, cleverly named Tranquilizer by Frank Berger, the person who was selling it, was also being marketed at that time. And the same kind of to-do that happened with Prozac many years later occurred first with Milltown, happiness pills. So for me, they're all part of the same movement going on at a similar time in American history. So I should list some examples of what's happened because of this domination or saturation. Since the mid-50s, we have witnessed the conversion of nearly every corner of our living space into a new niche for the marketplace, every activity into a leasable service with accessories for sale. Under this regime, the Civic Center has been replaced by the enclosed mall, and the Olympics have been reduced to a global trade fair. The charitable volunteer at your door is just another salesman working on commission, taking 30% of each donation towards saving the whales, and the shoes, shirts, and hats that we wear have been hijacked to serve as corporate billboards. Much worse and more insidious is this: our storehouse of memories is also overstocked with the logos and logic of commerce, where poems, parables, and patriotic songs once whispered in our ear to steer us through our lives, we now hear the ad man's rhyming jingles and the banal maxims of management gurus. I have a pretty long section on Tom Peters. I don't know if you people know his work at all. Another example of this is just everyday language. Language is my medium. I write fiction and poetry as well as this cultural analysis. If you just think, people shop for church these days. Universities and charities are worried about polishing their brands. Public school principals are being reinvented under the pressure from corporate philanthropists into CEOs. If you want to assess the final measure of value for anything, we call it what? The bottom line. That sort of metaphor creep. Even people who want to correct the system seem to be trapped in its tropes, so people who worry about the depletion of quote-unquote social capital. Certain people are treated as if they were living in the metaphorical world or the moral universe of capital. So what do I mean by the demise of virtue, which is part of my title? I'm using two dictionary definitions. The one, the most obvious, is the death or loss of position and status. But I don't mean just that. It's not just the death or loss of position or status, but also a secondary definition. This is an interesting one to me and fits my argument: a transfer of sovereignty to a successor. So it's not just the passing of a kind of ethical attitude or ethos, but it's the conversion or transfer of its authority to a successor. The phrase describes the ongoing conversion of traditional American values in both the Republican and Judeo-Christian accents to the ways, means, and ruling ideals of the postmodern corporation. This is going to be time for me to pull up the chart. Is it actually going to work?
Yep.
Yay. Oh, sorry. This is a chart I did. I don't do charts very often, so I get quite thrilled when I do a chart. I'll talk about what evangelical mammonism is in a minute, but the idea of character edit is what I'm getting at when I'm talking about the transfer of sovereignty. And on the left-hand side, I have a set of traits that I call virtuous America. I'm going to put a quick caveat on that in a moment. And the other side is virtual America, and then the arrows are to just show you the direction of the conversion or transfer of authority that I'm imagining has been taking place over the last 60 years.
Whoever has a copy of the book, that's the red tab in the book, is this chart also. It's up there.
I wanted to say some caveats about that, because all charts are reductive, though, and so to mention that, say three or four things first. Four qualifications apply to this. First, in noting, I really want to emphasize this, in noting this turn from a virtuous to a virtual America, I don't mean to suggest that there ever existed an ethical Eden here. I'm very anti-nostalgic, and I think anyone who's anti-utopian, and I'm anti-utopian, should be anti-nostalgic too, because they're really opposite sides of the same kind of temperament. I'm charting an active transformation in our conventional ideals, not just a collective failure to meet self-professed standards, which I presume to be a common occurrence in human affairs, and from which virtuous America, as I've been dubbing it here for this simple chart, has been no exception. Witness the nation's long-term hypocrisy on the issue of racial equality. Second, for the sake of visual simplicity, the chart avoids depicting the self-contradictory duality of traits. I mentioned them briefly before, I'll talk about it again, that we're supposed to behave like Dr. Jekyll at work and Mr. Hyde at home, that our economy actually requires of us. The chart's assertion that self-discipline, which is about the fifth one down there, is converted into self-indulgence, for example, favors the ethos of marketing over that of management, which for the sake of efficiency demands instead a strict obedience to its rationalized schemes. A more complete picture of the conversion underway, and one that you can't really get in a simple visual array like this, and a model for how some of the other conversions might be framed, would divide the demise of self-discipline in virtual America into two separate spheres: self-indulgence in the marketplace and submissiveness in the workplace. Third, I want to emphasize that not all of the qualities associated with virtual America are harmful in and of themselves. Often the danger emerges instead from the extremity of the allegiance they have now acquired, especially from the frequent extension of material means into moral ends themselves. Up to a point, after all, an increase in productivity can enhance generosity, generosity being devolving into productivity efficiency. Up to a point, it can increase it by multiplying the resources available to give. And also, in a different cultural environment, the old Plymouth Plantation, say, which I just visited yesterday, or a tribal Pakistan today, a little self-esteem might have proved to be a welcome corrective to an otherwise grim and guilt-ridden character. Finally, the last thing I want to say as a caveat is these changes are not complete or uncontested, as their simple visualization would imply. Long bedded in our customs and covenants and institutional structures, the traditional virtues do retain an appeal in our public and private deliberations, which is why their symbols are so often hijacked to mask their own decline. I'm charting a demise by degrees here, not an instant or automatic conversion. That said, over time, I want to claim, the co-opting of those virtues has become a real phenomenon. Humility and honesty haven't disappeared inside virtual America, but they do tend to get edited out by an economy that adamantly esteems the countervalues of self-promotion and salesmanship. And when taken together, these virtual values do form a mutually reinforcing moral field, that's the phrase I've been using, one whose current saturation of our civic spaces and electronic communications has been co-opting both a Republican and Judeo-Christian traditions of virtue. So the idea is a moral field, we enter a moral field inside this, inside America, this environment that has changed so much since the World War II period, though there were traces of it before. And the metaphor is sort of like imagining a gravitational pull. When you enter this field, you're being pulled in those directions. Some people may resist more than others, some institutions may resist more than others, but everyone is being drawn in that direction. And what I mean by that is we still have a diverse population, various ethnicities, religions, political parties, regional communities, and they do are different, but they're all being drawn, I'm saying, they're all being arguably drawn in that direction, so much as they enter the normal precincts of American life and use the normal telecommunications system. Okay, let me see where I am here. There's the chart, and you can look at it a little bit later on if you want. I'm going to move on from it a little bit. But just to say, under the moral regime, honesty gives way to salesmanship, friendliness devolves into networking, generosity is reconceived as productivity, heroes are replaced by celebrities, and faith is reduced to what we call prosperity theology now. In practical effect, this corporate ethos has been usurping the authority of church and state, even while shirking the social responsibilities that normally attend them. Let me anticipate now, next thing, anticipate an argument or objection. And that would be, doesn't participation in the free market economy induce responsible traits such as self-reliance and delayed gratification? And I want to say, well, of course that's true, and to agree it does, but there are three changes that have taken place in the period I'm discussing. In my view, first of all, the development of character is far more dependent on the moral health of families, neighborhoods, schools, civic and religious associations, all of which are being undermined by the current regime of monetizing and marketizing virtually everything. Second, we no longer live in an economy of independent farmers and shopkeepers. Most workers are instead wage employees, necessarily subservient to the moral order enforced inside their corporate offices, factories, sales rooms, and call centers. Furthermore, the spirit of capitalism, that phrase used by Weber, changed when it aggressively turned to consumer products starting in the early 20th century. As the economy became dependent on inducing mass consumption, the old traits associated with the Protestant ethic, including thrift, self-reliance, and delayed gratification, became incompatible with the marketing required to boost consumer sales. So, I'm arguing that the spirit of capitalism, the old argument, no longer applies, and what is the spirit of capitalism in our era as I see it? And that gets back to the title I had and the term that was unused. I've been calling the ruling spirit of our times evangelical mammonism. That spirit is evangelical, somewhat satirical, but with a real serious purpose behind it. The spirit is evangelical in that it is constantly touting the good news of one or more final solutions to the human predicament, economically to the elimination of the boom-bust cycle. You could have done an amazing collage of sound bites from economists who claimed before 2007 and 2008 that we had there would be no more busts, that we had solved it scientifically.
The great moderation.
Yeah. It was there, perfection once again, nearly on the horizon, yet never all so far away, like Gatsby's green light. Also, you remember Francis Fukuyama's theory of the communism collapse, the end of history, and then personally, the products that are going to solve all our personal problems for on a more personal level. So it's evangelical in that sense. And because the path pursued to achieve this utopian news focuses so fiercely on material improvements and acquisitions, it is aptly classified as a latter-day form of Mammonism. I deliberately chose that phrase because we are a Judeo-Christian and Republican culture, and in Judeo-Christian tradition, we have a critique for materialism. It's called Mammonism, but it's almost a funny thing. I had to come to the East Coast earlier. I typed up these notes on my sister's computer. I don't use spell check because I hate those red lines that come underneath. Microsoft Word does not recognize Mammonism as a word. Talk about denial. I mean... the core belief of evangelical Mammonism is the crude moral premise, nowhere true in the natural world, that more must equal better. More efficiency in the workplace and more consumption in the marketplace for more profits on the ledger. Under the sway of this evangelical Mammonism, all higher meanings, sacred or secular, are made to submit to the measures of money. What are the consequences of our submission to this evangelical Mammonism and the broad transfer of sovereignty mapped or graphed or charted up here to its moral compass? Well, on a national level, the consequences were made painfully evident in the greed-driven delusions that characterize the housing bubble. It could have been a chapter in Melville's Confidence Man, which is an important book and reference for me in writing this book. On a personal level, this ethos is punishing too, and I guess I want to emphasize that here among this audience. Its moral regime is extremely stressful, and in so much as it enforces two opposing sets of ideal behavior, one for behind the desk and the other for browsing in the mall, it is also deeply incoherent. Each of us is supposed to labor like Sisyphus and consume like Falstaff, the sum of which, as calculated by the fuzzy moral math of free market ideology, will also produce a naturally virtuous citizenry. But robotic efficiency plus sheer avidity, what Thomas Carlyle, the first great critic of capitalism, derided as mechanism and Mammonism, I kind of borrowed Mammonism from him, cannot lead to either personal happiness or civic righteousness, in my view. Last question I want to answer before I sort of sum up and turn it over to you is, how did we arrive at this state? Well, I'm not going to rehearse the 30 or 40 years of political history about the privatization movement, et cetera, which most of you are probably more familiar with. I want to think a little bit deeper here. When designing our democracy, the founders focused on prohibiting the two institutional enemies of freedom that they knew best, a centralized church and a monarchical state. Although uncommonly prudent for revolutionary thinkers, they never fully imagined and so didn't check and balance the political threat posed by the modern corporation. These highly specialized institutional bodies can produce economic goods in astonishing quantities, yet their internal governance, strictly rationalized methods serving narrowly materialistic ends, is neither Judeo-Christian nor democratic in nature. Consequently, the primary moral challenge to the American experiment, other than slavery, has been whether the productivity of these essentially amoral money machines, unimagined and so unrestrained by our Constitution, can be yoked to serve the same democratic purposes and Judeo-Christian values they internally refuse. Not just the subprime scandal that led to the Great Recession, but also the broader monetizing of our artistic, scientific, and religious practices highlight our current failure to pass that test. How are we doing for time, Eric? Do I have time to sum up here a little bit?
I'd sum up. Let's try to turn over to everybody.
Okay.
Because we'll circle back to these, I'm sure.
Yeah. So I've given my talk and my analysis. And it is that the resulting demise of virtue, that is the ongoing submission of our everyday lives toward the ways, means, and ruling ideals of radical capitalism, is a grievous error, that's what I'm going to claim here, and one that cannot be amended by a mere technical fix to our financial system. Real reform begins in recognition, or as some in this room might say, confession. As a precedent to effective change, we must begin by admitting then some hard truths about this virtual America that has become our all-enclosing house, even as it excludes the duties and delights of a communal home. Four things. A nation cannot license a set of inherently amoral money machines to run its workspaces, public gathering places, and primary media for telecommunications, and then expect the behavior of its people to remain morally sound. The core civic contention of the privatization movement, that ethical behavior is a kind of epiphenomenon of rationalized greed, that inside a fully marketized society, self-interest will routinely become enlightened, you know, enlightened self-interest, is a disingenuous delusion. As the housing bubble's astonishing scale of fraud and folly proved, it is a con game that we have played on ourselves, the particular way that, to cite Hamlet, reason panders will in an American accent. Second confession or recognition to make is that in a digital age when messages invade every social niche and private space, and with mobile commuting I mean every space now, a telecommunications system whose ruling intention is to promote acquisition will eventually, inevitably produce an overly acquisitive population. Third, when the profit motive prevails, when more money matters most, extreme efficiency at work and consumption at home will be pursued without consideration of the collateral social, psychological, and political damages that may result, for such damages no longer compute. They're not even recognized or measured in any kind of way within the system. And finally, my conclusion about this is that in so much as human beings are not machines, nor merely the sum of their physical appetites, the unbridled pursuit of efficiency and avidity of mechanism and mammonism on behalf of more money is not a ruling purpose worthy of our obedience, nor one conducive to cultural or psychological coherence, and no society, democratic or otherwise, can long survive its conversion to such dehumanizing lies. Charged with justifying the unbidden gift of consciousness in what sometimes seems but a blink of time, a successful life is both richer and harder than the bottom line can ever measure. And that's what I have for you. Yeah.